Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Joe Epstein, president of Sierra Steel Trading, a past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and your moderator for today's program. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker, Congressman Joe Sestak, a member of the House of Representatives and Democratic Senate candidate from Pennsylvania. We're very fortunate to have Congressman Sestak today as our guest. He's a 30-year veteran of the U.S. Navy and a second-term member of the U.S. House of Representatives. Congressman Sestak is a former three-star admiral and is the highest-ranking former military officer currently serving in Congress. During his distinguished naval career, Congressman Sestak led a series of operational commands, including commanding the USS George Washington Aircraft Carrier Battle Group during combat operations in the Persian Gulf and the Indian Ocean in 2002. This carrier group consisted of 30 U.S. and Allied ships, 15,000 sailors, and about 100 aircraft. He served as Director for Defense Policy on the National Security Council under President Bill Clinton. And following the September 11 attacks, he was selected to serve as the first director of Deep Blue, the Navy's internal think tank to provide strategic advice to the Chief of Naval Operations. After graduating from Cardinal O'Hara High School, Joe Sestak followed in the footsteps of his father, a Navy captain who served in World War II. He attended the U.S. Naval Academy and graduated second in his class. Congressman Sestak holds an MPA and a PhD in political economy and government from Harvard University. Despite efforts by the White House and his own party to drive him from the Senate race in Pennsylvania 9 months ago, Joe Sestak took on the establishment, and he ran a victorious race against Senator Arlen Specter. He is about to embark on what could be one of the most expensive senatorial races in the country. He will need the full support of his one brother, six sisters, his wife Susan, and of course their daughter Alexandra, as he faces GOP nominee Pat Toomey in the general election. So please give a warm welcome to Congressman Joe Sestak.
In case my daughter, who's 9 years old, is listening, there's also a dog, Bell. Thanks very much for the introduction. This is really quite an honor. When I was flying in last evening on the flight, we got in about 11 p.m., I was going through some of the parts of the speech, and this woman asked where I was going to speak, and I told her it was here. She says, "Wow, that's really an honor." She said, "Who are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm a sailor." And that's what I actually want to talk a bit about today in a roundabout way. But I also, when we were invited to speak, and Wendy, I'm very grateful for the invitation, and it's been great. And George, I very much appreciate how everything has worked out with my staff to make this so seamless, and Gloria Duffy, who I've worked with in the Clinton administration, thank you very much for having me, as Joe moderates. But when I came to understand the ilk of speaking here today, I was reminded of that story, and that's why I'm glad to see some people showed up. It reminded me of the story, I was concerned about the story about where this understudy finally gets their opportunity to take the main star's place on Broadway and sends out telegrams to all his friends saying, "It's my opportunity tonight." And when he got to the theater, there was nobody there. I went back to his dressing room, and there was one reply in a telegram from someone that said, "Thanks for the warning." So I'm very grateful you're here today on that. I did serve 31 years in the U.S. Navy before I ran for Congress. Much of that time, of course, was spent during the Cold War. President Reagan had a favorite phrase for working with our adversaries: trust but verify. These days, it seems like we need that kind of program down in Washington, except this time trust is no longer part of the equation. It isn't just politics. The trust of Americans has been devastated by fraud and failure in virtually every area of public life. People have been let down and led astray to disastrous consequences by government and politicians, corporations and titans of business, civic leaders and experts of all stripes. Unbelievable lapses of oversight and foresight have occurred across administrations and on the watch of both parties. The government of the people has rarely been held in such low regard. We must find a way to work together and move forward. We need to restore trust. I believe the only way to do that is with facts, accountability, and results. And as I speak today, I was taken as I went around those 67 counties of Pennsylvania, and as I was told to sit down, made a decision to get in. Because there's something that's different out there, and I'm not sure any of us understand it. When I entered the Navy in the midst of the Vietnam War, the military ranked last among our national institutions in the public trust. When I retired in 2006, it was first. And it wasn't just outside changes in geopolitics or the way America deployed our military. It was changes we had made ourselves in the way we measured and assessed plans and personnel, in rigorous oversight and strict accountability. It was a commitment to pragmatic leadership that gets results. That's what we're missing today. Pragmatic leadership where people are willing to say, here's where we are. Here's what I think we have to do based on the facts. Here's measurable benchmarks that we need to hit. And if we don't, hold me accountable. The lack of that kind of rigorous pragmatism is at the root of the mess we're in today. Making a commitment to that kind of leadership is, more than any specific policy, what it's going to take to overcome the litany of failures the American people have had to endure over the last 10 years. Our lexicon is swelled with shorthand phrases that have come to define our time. Enron, WMD, Katrina, Bernie Madoff, AIG. Not to mention a steady procession of elected officials and civic leaders who have violated the public trust. Out in Luzerne County, Pennsylvania, there were even judges caught running a Kids for Cash scheme, where they were sending juveniles to private detention centers in exchange for kickbacks from the owners. It seems like it's gotten to the point where disasters are piling up so quickly, we can't keep them straight anymore, let alone get any answers. The American people deserve an explanation. Instead, they're left with a growing tangle of questions. Years later, we are still left wondering, what caused the meltdown on Wall Street? What is it, the credit, the default, or the swap? We've watched a parade of CEOs insulate themselves from a company's failure or fraud by pleading ignorance of its most fundamental operations and seem distressingly genuine. We hold hearings to try to determine accountability for public or private policy, and we get an awful lot of, I don't know, from the people who are supposed to be the smartest guys in the room. We watch BP grapple with the biggest oil spill in American history with what seems to be a series of improvised experiments, top hat, hot tap, top kill, as evidence emerges that corners were cut to save money. We hear that oversight agencies stacked with industry insiders let energy companies fill out their own inspection reports. Months into the disaster, CEOs, government officials, and military officers can't seem to figure out who's in charge. People no longer wonder who has the answers. They just want to know if anyone really knows what's going on. The American people have faced extraordinary hardship, from terrorist attacks to natural disasters, but also disasters of negligence. Time and again, they've been told that tremendous sacrifice is urgently needed, but have only been given a vague idea what the plan is for when and how their investment in money, personal sacrifice, and trust will be repaid. As we try to restore trust, we can't repeat the same mistakes. There's no such thing as Republican government or a Democratic government. There's only the American government, the government by, of, and for the people. And today, the people don't think their government can do anything right, whether through a public program or oversight of business or keeping itself honest. We can't come along and tell the people that an economic collapse caused by handing a blank check to Wall Street is going to be fixed by a blank check to Washington. It's time to make a commitment to the American people, no more blank checks. We owe the public what any private investor could expect: concrete proposals, clear expectations, an honest accounting of cost, and straightforward assessment of the risk. The American people don't want politics. They want a prospectus. Most Americans don't care if we go left or right around an obstacle. They just want us to do it well. A lot of people out there feel like they're trapped between corporate greed or government incompetence. If you think it should be let up to the private sector, fine. But how are you going to make sure they're playing by the rules, not putting people at risk? If you think it's the role of government, okay. But let me see the plan of how we're going to measure results and not waste the people's money. The burden of proof is on us. If we have a plan to meet the challenges we face today, we must be willing and able to prove it. The public wants to know where we're going and why. The plan to get there, how long will it take and what will it cost? How can we tell if it's working or not? And if it isn't, they want to know, will we have the courage to change course? This really is the essence of pragmatic leadership. It's based in my mind on two rules we had in the Navy. One, amateurs do tactics, experts do logistics. And two, expect what you inspect. That means proper planning up front and real oversight along the way. The foundation of any policy must be detailed metrics to quantify why we need it, what we hope to get out of it, and specific benchmarks so we can measure at predetermined times what's working and what isn't. This applies to private enterprise as well as public policy. Government ought to demand it of industry and of itself. This isn't an expanded role of government. It isn't a new role of government. It is the role of government. It's not about big or small government. It is about effective government. For any proposal, if you can't offer measurable benchmarks, it means you have an idea, not a plan. Or you don't want to be held accountable for meeting them, and neither is acceptable. Amateurs do tactics, experts do logistics. If you can't give a calculated estimate of how long it will take to get there, then you don't know where you're going. We need detailed expectations, not hopes, assumptions, theories, or the best intentions. We've seen rule by ideology. Those who assured us wealth would trickle down from Wall Street to working Pennsylvanians promised that profit motive would motivate BP to protect our environment, or claimed that a Wild West financial sector would produce the most sound investments were wrong. Those tactics failed because the logistics never lined up. Tactics are what you want to happen. Logistics are how you make it happen. If you're able to lay out the logistics with real benchmarks, it means you're looking down the road and have crunched the numbers in a way that can be checked and measured. Basically, that you've done your homework. And that's what they want. This improves planning and gives us a basis for accountability if things go wrong. If we have clear expectations beforehand, we know when we've gone off course and can adjust. If we have checkpoints, we can tell if we're falling behind and assess what we need to then do. If things go totally bust, we've got the framework to find out who or what is really responsible and figure out how to prevent it from happening again. Of course, we can plan all we want, coordinate all the studies, lay out all the metrics, set out our checkpoints and objectives, and it won't amount to anything if there's no way to make sure we're sticking to it. That means real, effective, accountable oversight. Expect what you inspect. The military is based on trust and the capability and dedication of your fellow service members. But if you're in the businesses of running a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, then you're not in the business of just taking people's word for it when the nation's security may depend upon it. You've got to demonstrate you've got it and you've thought it through. Demonstrate you've done it. Demonstrate it's working. Again, it's what they want, rightfully. One of the most outrageous aspects of the problems we've experienced is how easy they would have been to see and avoid if we had made the facts, not the politics, the determining factor. The people want to know. Did anyone bother to map out how many troops we needed to occupy Iraq and realize we couldn't do it on the cheap? The Army Chief of Staff, General Shinseki, did. But he was shunted aside when his assessment didn't square with the administration's political goals. He was willing to stand accountable. But who was held accountable for overriding his objective assessment in the name of a political agenda? Did anyone bother to tally up the exploding derivatives market and realize their notional value had swelled to $700 trillion? That we were trading paper supposedly worth more than the world's total wealth. Warren Buffett did, and called them financial weapons of mass destruction, 4 years before the collapse. His warnings were ignored because the times, for the time being, were good. Did anyone do the math and see that the housing bubble was dangerously overinflated? It isn't true that no one saw the collapse coming. Hedge fund investors like John Paulson saw it coming and made billions on The Big Short, turning a dime on people being turned out of their homes. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan saw it too. But he refused to believe it because the facts didn't fit his theory that a deregulated market will always create the safest investments. He later admitted there was a critical flaw in his model that defines how the word world works. Time and again, leaders were accountable to politics or ideology, not pragmatism, and wouldn't let facts stand in the way. It's a mistake to think that pragmatic leadership isn't bold or daring. There's a difference between steadfast and stubborn, and it's all too easy to find a rationale to ignore the facts staring you in the face, but to look at the facts and say, I was wrong. That takes guts. Finding the problem and fixing it, that's the essence of leadership. It's also a mistake to argue that oversight is just about more bureaucracy that stands in the way of growth and innovation. It's not a choice between what's good for the people and what's good for business. If you've got big, heavy-handed government that gets in the way and wastes money, that's a problem. And no amount of agencies, rules, or regulators will make any difference if they lack the conviction and ability to do their job properly. For instance, in natural gas mines in Pennsylvania's Marcellus Shale and around the country, the EPA has been stripped of the authority to even know which chemicals drillers put into our water. On the other hand, if you've got banks and corporations that run amok with no oversight, that's a problem too. Enron, Lehman Brothers, AIG, BG, and a lot of other companies, and especially their employees and shareholders, would have been a lot better off with some effective oversight. Pragmatic oversight and accountability isn't about persecuting people and creating red tape. In fact, done right, it creates the innocent and can make sure we don't have needless regulation. The purpose of oversight is to establish the facts and act on them. In the absence of facts, there's a dangerous tendency to make them up. We risk falling into scapegoating. The young soldier in the field can be easy pickings for higher-ups who are eager to close the book on some investigation and call it accountability. We need to know who at the top made the call or let it happen. Who is refusing to step out and accept responsibility, accountability, and is letting someone else take the fall. Too many leaders blame others and want to hold positions of responsibility, but not accept the accountability that comes with it. Proper oversight gives us the record to show exactly where the buck stops. Similarly, if we don't have the facts, we end up finding something to blame rather than something to fix. We don't want to respond to reckless actions by corporations that fail to anticipate the consequences with reckless government that fails to address the real problem. For example, if we don't get to the bottom of what's really behind the financial meltdown, we're going to end up with unnecessary regulation in one area while the real problem goes unchecked. Unless we take the steps required to enforce this kind of accountability, we'll always have this sense out there that the perpetrator is still on the loose, that we've tamped down the fire, but not the hazard. Beyond challenging times, concern for our future, and a lot of justified outrage, I think there's a deeper uneasiness in America today. People feel that the American dream, the idea that our children, based on their efforts, will have the opportunity to do better than we have done, is broken. They know it's broken. A group of researchers, actually, from across the political spectrum came together and demonstrated that, for the first time in our history, Americans in their 30s are earning less than a generation ago, for the first time in our history, before the recession. Because this study was produced the year before the recession decimated the stock market, cost nearly 10 million American jobs, and wiped out $14 trillion in household health before that all occurred. The American people see major challenges on every front and are afraid no one really has a plan to deal with any of it. We don't even know the facts. Ask a person on the street, did the stimulus work? The voters don't know because it was never clear to them what it was intended to do. The administration oversold it. From the beginning, I argued that the stimulus would help stop the hemorrhaging of jobs, and it has, but that it couldn't be counted on to turn our economy around by itself. I didn't support it because of any political agenda. As you mentioned, Joe, my doctorate is in political economy. I crunched the numbers. I ran the modeling with economist Mark Zandi, who argued for an even larger stimulus package. He's not some liberal ideologue. He was chief economic advisor to John McCain. Today, every economist without a political agenda agrees that the stimulus was a necessary step, though not a silver bullet, that has improved our economy. But when voters don't have confidence that there's an honest broker and a clear plan, all they hear is a lot of sniping by politicians and pundits. And they know the careers of both are more often built on perception than reality. So you've got your conservative think tanks and liberal think tanks, Huffington Post or the Drudge Report. When the battle is about defining competing realities, it doesn't leave a lot of room for compromise. It isn't lost on the voters that in our two-state system, the out party can obstruct the ability of our nation to fix problems and be sure that in a few years, frustrated voters will have no choice but to turn back to them. It's also not lost on voters that this I win if you lose politics does nothing to help the American people. When a bank fails, it undermines trust in the banking system. If it keeps happening, you risk a run on all banks, whether they're solvent or not. In today's politics, there's a run on credibility. If we just tear down the credibility of others, we undermine our own as well. Voters don't want to have to choose between the Hatfields and the McCoys. We don't have black or white, either or challenges today. Meeting them is going to take pragmatic leadership that has the confidence to discuss the facts honestly, be straight with the American people, and work with the other side to reach a principled compromise. The biggest policy questions we have right now is how to weigh the urgency of creating jobs against growing concerns about the debt. We know our deficits is out of control, and our long-term debt threatens our future prosperity, but we also know one of the biggest factors contributing to the deficit is a shrunken tax base from a lack of jobs. Yes, we have to show more restraint. Yes, we have to cut waste. And yes, we have to structurally address our entitlement programs. But we cannot fix the deficit without first putting Americans back to work. If we spend money on a plan that isn't really mapped out or act according to political ideology, that amounts to a blind faith that Goldman Sachs has all the answers, we're going to make both problems much worse. The plan I have long advocated is based on providing tax credit to small business owners who hire new workers. Sure, it's nice to help out the mom and pop store and encourage the upstart entrepreneur, but that's not why I support this policy. I support it because in previous recoveries, nearly 80% of new jobs came from small businesses. Companies with fewer than 20 workers soaked up 40% of unemployed. Over the last 30 years, virtually all job growth has been in companies younger than 5 years old. They're the facts. Studies show that this plan would create 5 million jobs, recouping nearly half of the jobs lost in our recession. If there's a better way to put 5 million Americans to work or there's a flaw in this plan, then let's have a conversation about it. But I'm willing to say to the people, here's why I support it, here's how it'll work, here's what you can expect, and hold me accountable for the results. Whatever policy we pursue, it's going to take a pragmatic approach, an honest, constructive debate to get it right. We face a similar challenge in the war in Afghanistan. We cannot get caught in a quagmire that drains our treasury and readiness, strains our alliances, and ends up leaving us more vulnerable. We can't get caught policing an interminable civil war or stuck in an endless project of building another nation when we've got a nation that needs building right here. On the other hand, if we change course prematurely, we could leave al-Qaeda too much ability to plan against us and end up having to return because of their safe haven in Pakistan. If we do not address the threat there now, the cost in lives and treasure could be exponentially greater if that nation fails. As Director for Defense Policy and President Clinton's National Security Council, I helped develop a comprehensive strategy for our foreign policy. For any commitment, it required a clearly defined, achievable mission, an assessment of potential benefits weighed against the risk and cost, both human and financial, to the American people, a pre-established timeline and specific quantifiable milestones to reveal the extent of progress, and in every case, contingency plans if our goals are not being met, and a viable exit strategy in the event of failure or success. Tragically, this strategy was tossed aside by a Bush administration that viewed careful assessment as uncertainty and valued politics over pragmatism. President Obama promised a different approach. Speaking of Afghanistan, he said, "Going forward, we will not blindly stay the course. Instead, we will set clear metrics to measure progress and hold ourselves accountable. And we will review whether we are using the right tools and tactics to make progress towards accomplishing our goals." In announcing the surge of 30,000 troops, he said, "This effort must be based on performance. The days of providing a blank check are over." This is precisely the kind of pragmatic leadership we need for our nation, not just for Afghanistan, but for all the challenges we face at home and abroad. I supported the strategy regarding Afghanistan because of Pakistan, and provided that it be based on quantifiable metrics and clear benchmarks that would assess our progress and trigger a change in course if our goals were not being met in Pakistan. But now we need to see it. The metrics the administration has provided so far have not been sufficient and seem off point if al-Qaeda in Pakistan is truly the focus. At a hearing last week, I asked the Undersecretary of Defense if quantifiable metrics existed. She responded that many of the metrics are perhaps quantifiable. A metric, by definition, is quantifiable. We had been told the mission would be narrowly focused on eliminating the threat from al-Qaeda, operating out of a safe haven in Pakistan, not nation-building in Afghanistan. When I asked the secretary if we would be in Afghanistan if al-Qaeda were not in Pakistan, she responded that it was hard to answer a hypothetical. This issue should be central to our mission, not a hypothetical. We've been engaged in Afghanistan for longer than any conflict in American history, If we must continue to struggle and sacrifice to ensure the security of the American people, we will. But we must know we have a plan for victory, not a hope. We must have benchmarks and a clear trajectory to demonstrate to the American people that their sacrifice is necessary, that we have a plan that is working, and that our efforts can achieve a definable victory. This is the kind of leadership we need for Afghanistan and for all the challenges we face as a nation, because they are all intertwined. Even as we engage critical threats abroad, we cannot forget that national security truly does begin at home. My experience in the service taught me that the military can keep us safe, but our strength as a nation comes from the strength of our working families, their jobs, health care, and education. I believe we can only have a comprehensive strategy for our nation's future if we have the kind of leadership I've described. In conclusion, of course, we understand that we can anticipate and plan for everything. Many of the challenges we face in our lives and as a country are not the duty or responsibility of the president or federal government and are not under any person's or nation's ability to control. The best laid plans do go awry. But I'd like to offer two more Navy lessons that I try to use to guide my thinking. They seem contradictory, but they are all the more instructive because of this apparent contradiction. The first is that captains win before they engage. The second, every plan falls apart at first contact with the enemy. At some level, the plan is secondary to the planning. If your crew has the trust that you've done the work up front, studied the situation, know what to expect, and have the courage to change course when it's called for, they'll be with you. When you've got that kind of confidence, there's a sense somehow that you're always moving forward, even if events have thrown you back. And that's what we need today, that kind of leadership, to gain their trust. We feel like we're responding to crisis after crisis and tackling policies piecemeal without a clear sense of purpose. We can claw our way out of this recession, but what's the foundation for our future prosperity? How will we regain the competitive edge against China? We can stop the spill in the Gulf, but how will it put us closer to ending our dependence on oil? We can defeat Al-Qaeda in Pakistan, but how will we contain the threats emerging around the world? These are broad challenges, but meeting them begins in the details, the metrics, and our willingness to shape our policies around them. Lay out the benchmarks and be accountable for meeting them or adjusting to them. We need leaders who are public servants first, whose mission isn't to hold on to their jobs, but who are willing to lose their jobs to do what's right, who are willing to be held accountable. The American people are more patient, more understanding, more willing to appreciate complexity, and more willing to accept short-term sacrifice for long-term gains than they get the credit for. They understand that no plan is perfect, and not every benchmark will be met. But we need to bring them into the mission. The issue in our politics today isn't the Tea Parties. I respect many in the Tea Party movement. And there is justifiable outrage in our country, left, right, and center. But there are also ideas. We're the only nation founded on an idea, on a principle. Competing views are all part of a national character that has contributed to our progress. The ongoing American conversation about who we are as a nation, who we aspire to be, and the role we seek in the world. We are a people defined by our country, and a country defined by its endeavors, not just what we are trying to achieve, but what we are trying to become. Times are tough. Come to Pennsylvania. And will be. But if the American people have confidence in pragmatic leadership, we can have the confidence that despite any setback, our nation is, as always, moving forward towards that vision we have set for ourselves. I appreciate this opportunity. It's different out there. You've given me an opportunity to try to define what I see the American people in my state marrying to us. I want to be a public servant, not a politician. I don't want to just be responsible. I want to be held accountable. And I want to help lay out what the expectations and plan is to give them back the belief that they might trust again. With that trust, we can do anything. I sincerely believe that. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Congressman Joe Sestak, also candidate, Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate from Pennsylvania, for his remarks today and his theme, A New Pragmatism. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I'll be moderating today's program. The first group of questions, and we've got a lot of ground to cover, Congressman, is what I think is really the elephant in the room, and I'd like to kind of get it behind us and have you answer these questions about the Hatch Act, which is a 1939 act, and the question is as follows. How much do you want to say, or how much will you say, regarding the potential violation of the Hatch Act earlier this year by the White House, and specifically the White House Chief of Staff, Rahm Emanuel? I'm sure most of us know the story, but very briefly, the story is that Emanuel contacted President Bill Clinton, who discussed with you whether or not you would consider dropping out of the primary election against Senator Arlen Specter in exchange for a non-paying post on an administrative advisory board. So that's the background. If you could comment on that, please.
I have nothing more to add of what I've said. It was no secret the Democratic establishment wanted me out of the race. But I wanted to be the senator from Pennsylvania to help out people who are working and want to work. I said no. I'm not into the politics and that stuff. I think this nation's got to get going again, and that's all I focus on. And that's what I want to do when I'm the senator, is just pragmatically come up with the right practical solutions. Thank you.
I can promise you I won't beat this dead horse to death, but there are quite a few questions, and I will try to get through those then quickly on that topic. So was the call from President Clinton the only call that you received?
Yes.
And what position did the Obama administration offer to you? And you've already commented why you decided to turn it down, so we want to
ask. Well, as I said in the interview, and is or whatever the press conference is, I wasn't even sure what it was. I heard presidential and board. I thought I just kind of interrupted. I didn't mean to be rude and say no.
There are some Republicans, I believe, who feel that that Eric Holder, our Attorney General, should be looking into this. I think he has, and as far as I could tell, he's decided against taking any action to prosecute an investigation. Is that true?
My understanding is yes, but look, right now outside, of course, I don't know San Francisco very well. Mm-hmm. But people outside in Pennsylvania aren't worried about my job. They're worried about hit theirs or trying to get one. And so as we get to the real good questions that might matter to them, that's all I'm interested in. And they are, too. Again, the conversation with the American people of what matters to them, where they've been slammed and ripped apart. And then people want to talk about politics. I'm a sailor. I get it. I'm a terrible politician. I got it. But to me, we got to pragmatically start approaching some of these issues. And I hope the question soon.
Do you think the issue of the White House asking you not to run would have any effect on the way that you and the president
No.
are working together?
Absolutely not.
And will work together.
Well, actually, I did. I said, you know, Mr. President, when they offered to come in, I said, I really love Michelle first. Not because of him, but she's something, as he is.
She is, right. Why don't we segue over to the issue of the incumbents, both congressmen and senators. Incumbency seems to be in trouble. Predictions for the fall elections, the repercussions are how many seats will be lost in the House and the Senate, and how likely is the president to move to the middle to triangulate, as President Clinton did, to avoid this loss of incumbency?
I don't know about the president. And incumbency, I don't know about that either. I think if people have a perception and they understand that the reality is that you're on their side, not the side of a Wall Street that somehow you permitted to have the regulation dismantled so they might play roulette with the homes and the savings of families in Pennsylvania, that somehow you believe that large corporations can be useful, but that there's some oversight that's needed so that the damage to the livelihoods of Americans isn't forsaken, and that you're on the side of working families. I'm not sure it matters if you're an incumbent or not. I believe that you're first a representative, and then, in my case, a congressperson. We keep our office open 7 days a week. On Saturdays and Sundays, it's open to 9 o'clock, because people can't come to my office if they're working during 8 to 5. We've handled four times the constituency cases of the average congressional office. 865 home foreclosures we've handled out of our office. My district is about 53-55% Republican, 33-35% Democrat. My first race, we had to raise $3.5 million to win in 8 months. My second race, we didn't put a dime into anything but yard signs. We felt they'd come to trust us. They don't always agree with me, but they felt we were there on their side. But I want to go down to Washington and fix, whether they're incumbents or not, I do think Washington's a bit broken, fix the source of the damage that causes us to keep our office open 7 days. You know, a captain of a ship sits down with his or her crew and always lets them have a cut of their jib. My take is that's what's needed. That's the conversation that's needed. So I can't judge what others are But I feel that's what's most important right now, sir.
Congressman, we were speaking for a few minutes before the program today, and you were telling a few of us that it seemed like an epiphany that came to you at a point when you decided that it was appropriate for you to run. Could you kind of go over that in your own words?
Yeah, I had to. I had been asked to get in the race last February. You go February, and I didn't want to when Arlen Specter was still a Democrat, because I had gotten in because my daughter had a brain cancer when she was 4 years old, and so I needed to address that issue and got out. Ran for Congress to pay back this nation because I wanted everybody to have the health opportunity I had in the military under TRICARE. It was payback. So I had no interest at the time of running for Senate. But after about 2 months, I finally agreed, and then Senator Specter became a Democrat. I then was asked to sit down. I went to the 6-7 counties of Pennsylvania to decide whether to get in or not. And then they're all great counties, but Potter County has this wonderful sign as you drive in. This is a year ago July. Let me see, was it last July? Time goes quickly on a campaign. And it has this wonderful big sign as you drive into the county. It says, God's Country. And it's beautiful. And I was meeting with some people, and one of them was a farmer, and I said to him, how's the recession? Because this was last July. And he said, not too bad. I was hurting already so much. Right then, I knew that something needed addressal. And that's about the time where I decided that I'm going to get in to run.
Well, you said it's going to cost you anticipate $3.5 million.
Well, that's what my congressional race did. That's peanuts.
And so what do you anticipate for the senatorial race?
I really don't know. I would imagine most people say 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I'll have sufficient resources. I think people have to look around. A lot of this is, look at the race that I just won, the primary. We have 1.3 million more Democrats in Pennsylvania than Republicans. But if the same percentage of Democrats come out as did in that primary as Republicans, and mind you, we had a national almost race going on. On the Republican side, there was just kind of somebody running for governor and somebody running by themselves almost for Senate. But if those respective mounts come out, it's going to be a tough road. So you'll see us focusing a lot on how we run this primary, message, field, and others, and all. But I think it's important for Democrats to understand they aren't pouring into the polls right now. Even they feel as though something's been lost.
Well, whatever the amount is, it's going to be very expensive. As you may know, we have a candidate for governor, California, Meg Whitman, who was apparently spent $65 or $75 million and still going on her own campaign here. So it can really get very, very expensive. And it certainly begs the next question, your view on campaign finance reform. What are your thoughts about that? And what about public finance of campaigns? And what about limiting the duration of the campaigns?
Yeah, I am co-sponsor of a bill for public financing of campaigns. If you took the money out of politics, you'd take 80% of the problems out of problems we have down there. I really believe that. I'm not sure you want to, as I think they do in Britain, extend the length of how you do it or not. I'm not, you know, people pay attention or don't pay attention when they want to. And that happened in our primary. A lot of people were looking at polls early on, but people had lost their jobs or they were trying to hold on to them. They weren't thinking about a primary to the last couple of weeks, and basically that's how we planned for it. But I enjoyed going around the year before because I was learning stuff. And I think there's value to a candidate, like when Mrs. Clinton and Mr. Obama went through as candidates in Pennsylvania through a primary. I think the president, as a candidate, became a stronger candidate because of the length of that primary and having exposure and listening to us and what we had to say. So I'm not about limiting the time, but I would love to see public financing because then I could do more work on legislation, keep the office open 8 days a week. But, I mean, you can really get more done. And then I'll beat the guy every time because I'll have more time to do more things for families that are working or want to work. And that's how I look at it.
Well, let's just take a moment here to say you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Congressman Joe Sestak, a member of the House of Representatives and Democratic Senate candidate from Pennsylvania. Congressman Sestak is discussing his views on the economy, which we will be doing in a minute, oil drilling, which we will also be doing in a moment, and national security. And thinking or talking about national security, this is a good time to segue into some questions on the international front. I know you talked about Pakistan in your prepared remarks, but here's a specific question. Do you still believe that Pakistan could be a stronger ally against our struggles with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban if we could convince them to stop focusing on India as their prime enemy? Why can't the U.S. and other Western allies work with India and Pakistan to put down their arms, fight a common enemy like Al-Qaeda and other global terrorist groups?
You mean work with India and Pakistan?
Yes.
Right. Whoever asked the question, it's a great question. Pakistan, it's almost like Samuel Johnson said several centuries ago, there's nothing like the prospect of a hanging to focus your mind. So when the Taliban got to within 60 miles of Islamabad 2 years ago, that was when the four major pillars of Pakistan's government, the two parties, intelligence, a service, and the army came together, pulled divisions off the front with India, and started to address their own salvation. And that is what, in a closed hearing, Secretary Gates mentioned, that the purpose, a major purpose, of the increase in troops was to seal the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan, so that convincing the Pakistanis that they were as endangered as we might be threatened by an al-Qaeda that could have a safe haven to plan against us, they would go from south to north Waziristan through the Taliban to the al-Qaeda safe haven where we can't go. But the Taliban wouldn't be able to flow over the border away from them, so they wouldn't spread the bets and try to make an accommodation and ultimately fail. So that's the challenge, and why today I argue, as I wrote the president a year ago, argued, where is our exit strategy, which are merely benchmarks, importantly benchmarks, by which we measure success and failure? Because it's not about Afghanistan. I think Karzai is so corrupt and inept, we never should have depended upon it. Afghanistan is a base to stop what threatens us, which is al-Qaeda, and Pakistan's potential failure. As The Economist said 2 years ago on the front page of the issue, Pakistan, the most dangerous place in the world. We may get the nukes out if they fail, but not the 2,000 scientists trained in the most radical of Islamic universities with the knowledge of and access to the radiological material that will be resident there. Coming together with Taliban and al-Qaeda, how are we measuring our success? How we have the metrics to see if we're succeeding? As I wrote the president and General Jones responded with, I felt, an insufficient answer, because we don't have it for measuring if we're partnering and making that happen. And that's my concern, is we can't afford an open-ended commitment on the hope that Pakistan is coming and aligning. Are they, and are they moving? And to me, that measurement is what we need to assess if the plan is working.
This is a more general question, and maybe it should have even preceded the one on Pakistan and India, but could you elaborate on what you described as the four security pillars and why you believe that they are the foundation for our national security?
I actually now have five. I missed one my first year. But, everybody flip-flops in politics. I didn't want to be a flop flipper and add one in the middle of my first campaign. But as I mentioned in my comments, militaries make you safe. They don't make you strong. The proper investment in our health, our education, our economic security, those three pillars, as well as environmental energy security, are what gives us healthy, productive youth, educated, that give you our strong defense. That's national security. National security is not defense security. Militaries don't fix problems. We can stop them. But as for an example, I was on the ground at the beginning for a short period of time, very short, in Afghanistan when I headed Deep Blue. We had an edifice of security that the military had provided there. And then we went to Iraq. We had not given time for the other elements of our power. For example, fix the illiteracy rate of women in Afghanistan, which is 98%, and you do more for the global war terror than anything done today. And the 2% that are literate can just about write their name. So my issue when I ran was to tell people, look, we have if you believe in a strong defense, fine. But our America is strong because of the investments in our securities of health, education, and economic. And that's why I went to committees like Education Committee, Health Subcommittee, Small Business Committee. And I'm on defense because I can pivot and show a program that doesn't work and move the first funding in 12 years into autism in the federal government. Because one of every 110 youth today is born with autism. It's another crisis about to explode on us if we don't get it right. And so that's why I believe that national security begins at home, and those four pillars that give you defense, that's national security.
Thank you. As a former naval commander, what advice would you give Israel regarding the Gaza blockade, which took the media space for a whole week last week?
Yeah. I think that our administration and Israel has to remember what the overall objective is, and that is a two-state solution. I feel in the first 7 years of the Bush administration, we abdicated our engagement in the world. We outsourced the leadership for North Korea to China. We outsourced the leadership for Iran to the European Union. And in the Middle East, I don't know who we outsourced it to until the Annapolis Conference happened, a little too late. Having been at the National Security Council when the strategy of engagement was developed by President Clinton, I believe that our engagement there is not about the settlements in isolation or blockade in isolation. How well we are in the room with the parties to negotiate, not mandating, but where they become pregnant in the development of it themselves, as they did in Oslo, is what this is about. So for me, it's not to advise on this particular blockade. I do believe we have vital interest. And Israel is a vital interest of ours. Its security affects our security. It's vital to our interest. We have important interest, global warming, which changes the character of the world that affects us. And we have humane interest. Rwanda, what a failure. And so my issue is how well we address these to children, clean water, but always remembering first vital interest towards the ultimate goal of a two-state solution, as we came this close under President Clinton to achieving, is what this is about. And that's what I, when I sign letters, always put an addendum, always put something out to say, we have to engage and be the leader, because organizations or nations won't take risk, I think, for peace without U.S. leadership being out there.
Let's tail off on international and the military with these two questions. How has your career in the Navy affected your policies on Veterans Affairs?
I spent a lot of time in Veterans Affairs. The Bush administration underfunded the Veterans Administration by $8.5 billion. The first 2 years under Ms. Pelosi and others, we increased that funding $10 billion, not authorized, appropriated. The Bush administration kicked out of VA for health benefits people who made just over $14,000. 1 million vets don't have health care today because of a ruling in 2003 that Clinton had actually brought them in a decade earlier. We've gotten 250,000 of them, piece of legislation that I submitted, back in under PAYGO, where we didn't add to the debt. And this president has them all coming in within the next 4 to 5 years. But I think to the bigger point, I spent Veterans Day in prison. That wasn't my old sailor days. I went to visit vets in a correctional institute, Chester, medium security. Because, you know, Veterans Day, no one goes and visits vets in prison. And yet they serve. 47% of all vets in Pennsylvania are there because of a drug or alcohol-related crime, where they come home, and they were Vietnam through Iraq. They come home with PTSD. We so sorely underfunded the VA. And then we don't kind of outsource some of it to communities where the soldier might feel more comfortable seeking help than just going into a cold VA building. They come home, just like Vietnam. Remember we had two recessions? We have one here now. No job, PTSD, seek help and a substance, a crime to steal, maybe with a gun, and they're in prison. This war and the cost it's going to be, as well as Harvard said, over $2 trillion. So I spent a lot of time on it. My classmate from the Naval Academy, who's Mark Peterson's classmate, Bill Walsh, runs my office, and we spend a lot of time in this area and will continue to do so.
Could you finally comment on your views for Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
Yeah, that should have been, I think we should repeal it right away. I went to war with a certain percentage of men and women who, by public surveys, we knew were gay. How can you come home and say they don't have equal rights? So when I got to Congress, I co-sponsored it, the bill to repeal it. I don't understand a military that on a dime can turn and take us to Afghanistan, and in something that actually asks an institution to live a lie, an institution that prides itself on integrity, why we can't more readily get it reversed rather than waiting until the study's done. But we have to do more. DOMA has to be repealed, Defense of Marriage Act. ENDA needs to be passed. If there's anything I learned in the military also, besides expect what you inspect, is black, white, purple, green, it doesn't matter. When I joined up with Mark, we were having race riots on aircraft carriers during Vietnam. We worked our way through that to Colin Powell became chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Women in combat positions, I offered to be the first test ship for that. And when I arrived years later off Afghanistan, I put up among 8 pilots that first night, a woman F-18 pilot, first time overseas. She was the one that night that saved 4 special forces when their 4 comrades had died in an ambush and got them out. My point is, it's not just about equality. The institution of the military will be stronger and better if we take the best of the best from all demographics. We benefit by having them be part of the fabric of the military.
Congressman Sestak, we have time for some questions on energy. Let's start off with the cap-and-trade issue. I've heard that you support a cap-and-trade system to fight climate change and promote clean energy, an audience member asks. How do you answer the GOP's assertion that this would devastate the economy of a coal state like Pennsylvania?
This is the kind of issue that we need to look at the facts and have a conversation about and not just listen to assertions. I think four studies have been done so far on the cap and trade bill passed by the House of Representatives. There's 4 principal reasons that I support it. First, we have to wean ourselves off foreign oil. 67% of our oil comes from volatile areas of the world, the Middle East, Africa, places that we don't want to have to rely upon unnecessarily. It's a defense security issue. I patrolled those lines of communications during the Iraq-Iran war. Second, it has to do with the health of people. Global warming is a serious issue. You come to Pennsylvania, and almost all counties are in violation of EPA standards for air particle and ozone. We're just in violation. My daughter's growing up in an unhealthy environment. Third, it has to do with jobs and opportunities. All studies have shown on the cap and trade bill that somewhere approximately 75,000 jobs we create in Pennsylvania and 1.7 million on average across the United States. Plus, if we permit global warming just to proceed unabated, you get less in crop yields, you get less in milk production. It's going to affect us in Pennsylvania. And last, does it cost? Yes. About a postage stamp, a little less per household for a few years until sometime about 2020, about 8 years later after we begin. There are savings between $215 to $1,100, depending upon which study you look at, of energy efficiency. As I end this comment, I backpacked through China in the mid-'80s, the first year they let independent travel for Americans. And I remember going on the 5th class of their trains at the time. They were just slats for the floor. You could see the rail ties passing as you sat there on these wooden seats. And moms would pick up their kids and hold them over the slats, their babies, and let them go to the bathroom right through the slats. Today, China has surpassed us in alternative energy. It's the number one producer of solar power. We are one of its 5 biggest importers in solar power. This is about competition also. And sitting down and walking through this, I think is extremely important, because the assertions are that, assertions, and we need to have a very hard dialogue on this, and that's why I'm a large proponent of it.
Well, we've essentially ran out of time, but I'm going to try to squeeze in a question, as I often do. It's a question that really requires a lot of thought, but maybe you can give us your quick take on it. Similar to the lack of regulation in the financial industry, President Obama has recently appointed a new head of the Minerals Management Service. How did this agency fall so far down in the exercise of what we now know is a critical job of oversight in drilling for oil offshore?
There's this culture that I spoke about today as I wrap up, where people do feel responsible but not accountable. We knew in 2007 about the gifts and the bribery and that was occurring, and the very close relationship between big oil and MMS. In 2008, 2 years ago, an Inspector General's report was conducted and completed that laid it all out. And for whatever reason, neither administration went in and made it accountable. Why does it take a crisis? But I grew up in the Navy, and I saw the same thing. My last year as a three-star admiral, I was placed in charge of trying to change the Navy. I had done some analysis, quantifiable, that showed we were probably not building the best Navy. I argued we didn't need 316, 315 ships. We needed about 250. Mark, I was cutting those submarines too. We didn't need 55. About 33 was probably the right number, if we invested in knowledge. 80 Chinese submarines. Now, China's not an adversary, but just take it. 55 of ours. Are you going to go one-on-one? Or how about these small little Coke cans developed that could distribute hundreds and thousands of them, a little hydrophone with little antennas that could communicate among themselves exactly where that submarine is, and then fly a plane over if you want to? The transition to a change, I think, has hurt us. We're now down to 277 ships, often of the wrong type. That plan of mine, we got a plan over to Congress, but it didn't survive more than a year. So change has happened. And as I end, or is that the last question, if I could tell?
Yeah, well,
as I end, first, thank you for being here. Second, this last question is key. Everybody wants to be a leader and take us out of a crisis. We're going to make the Gulf better than it ever has been. I respect that. But why not make it the best it's ever been a couple years ago, if that's what we needed to do? That MMS is a prime example, because sometimes when you go in and you want to establish a different set of metrics that changes something, or heaven forbid, stay in a campaign because you think the establishment might have it wrong by endorsing someone that advocated for the other side, can cause, as the first couple questions were of this, some consternation, some uneasiness. It's hard for someone to come in and actually take a stand and make a change, because people don't like change in a bureaucracy and areas. But if there's ever a moment, not just for change, but to actually believe that standing up and doing things right and letting the consequences on you personally and professionally prevail, despite whatever they might be, now's the time. They don't trust out there, and I don't blame them, because that MMS is, how could we let that happen? We're the government. We're supposed to have a role of effectiveness that makes sure that they can be all they can be. And we somehow let them down. And so I very much appreciate the opportunity to be here, because it helped me put my thoughts in better order. But I'm taken And I don't know how exactly it is here in the city, but I believe what I see in Pennsylvania is rift across this nation. I think Massachusetts didn't vote against the Democratic Party and for the Republican Party. They said, pox on both your houses. We voted for a change, not just in policy, but in politics, to where principles should triumph over politics. You can have principle compromise, but not a compromise of principle. I think the courage of one's conviction will do more to move this nation towards regaining the trust that we had to in the military when we were there, and they became proud of us. I'd like to be part of that team that actually helps make that happen, to where they're proud once more of those who should be public servants, not politicians. So thanks for having me today.
Our thanks to Congressman Joe Sestak, member of the House of Representatives and Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate from Pennsylvania. We also thank our audiences here and on radio and the Internet. I'm Joe Epstein, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you are in the know, is adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Congressman.